Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
To watch the political machine respond to things, it's being able to see it's sickening. But I say all that to say that really sparked a reaction here in Savannah. The chief at the time said, "You know what? Screw this." He was born and raised in Savannah, a real Savannah guy, a real cop, Vietnam vet, Willie Lovett. Sat down with the mayor. Mayor said, "Do something about it." So Willie said, "Okay." So he put 17 of us together. It was basically a goon squad, a hit squad. We called it EXPO, the Expanded Patrol Operation. And we had countywide jurisdiction. And we just rode. We didn't answer calls for service. We went and found the bad guys. We didn't stop little old ladies for traffic violations or anything like that. We went into all our high crime areas, and we went looking for the guys we knew were pulling triggers. And we found a whole bunch of them. So,
excellent. Excellent. So you guys got EXPO going, and here's, you know, I lost my train of thought a while ago, and here's the point I wanted to make. You had mentioned proactive versus reactive policing, and reactive is you're answering to calls after crimes have been committed, whereas proactive, you're going out and searching for the crimes before they happen. And that's the way it really should be, and that's what you can do when you have sufficient manpower out there to do that. But we all know, especially nowadays, I mean, even DEA, they can't. You know, if a basic training class goes through and has 50 basic agent slots, they're lucky if they can get 35.
Yeah, it's not a place, you know, after 2014, it's not a place where people want to be anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and especially the type of policing that we did in 2006, it's not allowed anymore. Mm-hmm. And the thing that really sucks about that is it's effective. And, well, you know, the only thing I'll disagree with you there on manpower is you can make it happen with a small number of guys, mm-hmm. but you need to have the right ones. You need to right. have the people that are very good at what they do. You know, they need to know what they're doing and well-trained and that kind of stuff, which at that time, like I said, I had 4 years, 4 months on the street. So I didn't really have the experience, but the guys on the team with me very much did. And I you know, soaked all that in. I learned so much from the guys that were around me. But the opportunity at that time to go out and get it, you know, you got young, hungry police officers that want to go out there and learn. And I was smart enough to know that I didn't know shit, mm-hmm. but I was around guys that did.
And you were smart enough to learn. And, exactly. and the other thing you got to have is the backing of the chief and the executive staff and the city council, the mayor.
Which is the biggest problem in our society today. As you mm-hmm. know, you got these politicians that are getting voted in and that kind of stuff. And they say, we want to keep crime down. But when the police actually have to go out and do what they do, they don't want that. They don't want to answer for that. And Mayor Otis Johnson, former mayor here in Savannah, was all about it. Chief Willie Lovett was all about it. We had one captain that kind of oversaw the operation, and then we just had our sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically answered directly to the chief.
Excellent.
The chief said to us, "Hey, go fix this." So we did.
So tell us what EXPO was doing.
Oh, man. I love to tell people what EXPO did.
Oh, he gets, for our listeners, he gets a shit-eating grin on his face when he says
Oh, man. It was, we did it for 11 months, and it was best 11 months of my professional career. Absolutely loved it. Because again, we were not going out to write headlight tickets or taillight tickets or seatbelt, that kind of stuff. Now, we stopped everybody for all of those things. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't have dope, guns, warrants, hand grenades, stuff like that, we cut you loose and went on to find the next stuff. But, you know, everything now is so driven by statistics. Everything we look at, and I agree, you know, stats are very, very good to give you an idea of what's going on if they're accurate numbers. The thing is, that gives you a very good idea of where to go, but you got to know what to do when you get there. So, you know, we didn't have any maps or charts or anything fancy like that, but our team was made up of guys. So my partner in crime, Josh Hunt, who's now like, I think he's the chief of investigations for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in Chicago.
Wow.
He and I came from downtown and we knew downtown. We knew everybody, everywhere, every neighborhood where we wanted to go downtown. Then Central Precinct, which was the bigger and probably more like higher crime areas in Central Precinct. It had guys like Rufus Brown and Floyd Sawyer that came from there, and they knew that precinct very well. And each officer that was on the team came from different precincts, and they knew where we needed to go. So we would just meet up. Our sergeant would, and I'll never forget the original speech. You know, the original speech was basically, listen, these guys have rights. We're going to come to within an inch of them. Mm-hmm. But they have rights. And we pushed the envelope. We were very aggressive. We went, you know, policy was no pursuit and that kind of stuff. So we didn't pursue anybody, but we followed them closely. You know, we did what was necessary. But,
that's all how you write it up.
Yeah, exactly. It's all in the how to articulate. And boy, that's boy, right. Did I learn how to articulate things. But we had a nasty reputation as being two-fifths. A nasty reputation of being, you know, like questionable searches and stuff like that, which comes from people who are not doing it, sitting back and looking. But I can assure you, when we were actually doing it, we were doing it the right way. Now, right. We were going to try to learn, like, hey, can I stop him for that? Like, I can't find a reason that I know of to stop this guy. What do you, and, you know, the guy next to me would be like, this. And then we would go and we would bounce that off assistant district attorney and say, look, We had this situation. Could we have stopped him here? And that's where I learned about tier one encounters as opposed to tier two encounters, as opposed to arrests and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And for 11 months, 12 hours a day, you know, you couldn't get us to go home. You know, if we came in one time and Sarge told us we were only working an 8-hour day, he had to explain that shit because we did not, you know, we didn't want, you couldn't get enough done in 8 hours. We wanted, you know, we went out, but that was a time in policing where I would go out and make an arrest. The guy would have a little bit of marijuana on him. So Josh would see that and be like, man, you're not locking somebody up. So Josh would go arrest somebody and he'd have a little bit of powder on him. And Rufus would see that and he would go out and get somebody with crack and a gun. And at the end of the day, we'd be like, all right, Rufus wins today, but I'm going to get it tomorrow. Yeah. You know, and we made each other better. It was always very competitive. But we learned from each other. We went out there, you know, and I try to make it sound like it's a contest, but we were very driven to be the best out there, you know, and we were trying to do that. And we learned a lot. Like I learned just from watching Rufus, how he got this, you know, how he made this case, how like street surveillance techniques and all of those things. But that was the atmosphere then. Now it plays out a little more. I would go out and make that first arrest and get a little bit of marijuana. And Josh and Rufus would sit back and say, well, he didn't really have a reason to stop him. You know, it wasn't, that's not what they do anymore. You know, right. It's more, I don't want to be better myself. I'd rather critique somebody else and make them lesser than what I think they are, which yeah. is the wrong way of going and doing things.
So it's safe to say that Expo is targeting the most violent criminals, right?
We were after the worst of the worst, for sure.
And that's, you know, the reason I say that is I used to run the mobile enforcement team for DEA for 2.5 years and out of Atlanta. And you know, we covered Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, and had gotten a request to come over to Savannah to do a deployment. And we would go in for 4 to 6 months and set up an undercover office. And we weren't going after the big drug traffickers. We were going after the most violent drug traffickers that were identified by the agencies that asked us to come in. And of course, they had to participate. You know, you set up an undercover office. We got everybody rental cars and things like that. And they could be ounce dealers at most, but they would have murder convictions and aggravated armed robbery convictions and kidnapping and strong arm robbery. All the violent crimes. That's who you're. And it sounds like that's who you guys are going at. I was shocked at how dangerous, I guess, how mean Savannah was.
Savannah's a tough town. I've done a lot of interviews and a lot of podcasts, stuff like that. And I always call it the Boston of the South. It's beautiful. It's historical. Mm-hmm. It's a traditional city. Absolutely gorgeous. But holy shit, is it alive. There's, I think, but anywhere you have poverty, you're going to have drugs. Anywhere you have drugs, you're going to have guns. Anywhere you have guns, you're going to have violence. And that's what's going to happen. The thing is, I hate the term. I despise the term gun violence. Murph, violence is violence. It doesn't matter. If we didn't have guns, we'd be hitting each other with bricks. Yep. It goes back. We've been killing each other long before we, you know.
Before guns were invented.
So it's not a gun violence problem. It's a violence problem.
Yeah, it's, and gun, I think, is just a convenience.
And if we stop focusing on the tools and start looking at what the real problems are, then maybe we'll solve something. But that's, it doesn't seem to be the American way.
Whoa.
Sorry.
That's deep, man. That is deep. And you know what? You're dead on. I mean, absolutely. Yeah, in my opinion, that's
well, and it, the thing is, like, I have no, I don't even bat an eye saying those things because I've seen it, you know, in the street. And it's not the tools. That's not why it happens. It's the conditions that lead up to it. And if we're not addressing those conditions, you know, and it's not a police department's job. A police department's job is not to educate our kids. It's not to create jobs. That's what the government's for. That's what all this has. Police work is very, very, very simple. And I don't care what level you do it at. Ultimately, you're trying to gain voluntary compliance with the law, and you keep the good people safe from the bad people.
Yeah,
it's that simple. Yeah. All this social work, all these things, and while I understand that's what it's evolved into, and if police departments can help with that, it's great. But ultimately, we can't get away from the fact you just got to keep good people safe. Protect the people that can't protect themselves. It's an age-old concept, and you can dress it up as much as you want. But as soon as you lose sight of it, which I believe we have with all our statistical analysis and politics and all that kind of stuff, once you lose sight of the fact that the only job for the police is to keep people safe, you're screwing the whole thing up.
Well, I'm sure you've seen it too, because I know you have, because 15 years in, it's law enforcement. Your law enforcement agencies become the dumping grounds for things that nobody else wants to handle. You know, so everybody says, well, he has a mental issue. You should have dealt with that. Hell, I minored in psychology. I majored in law enforcement, and I was a law enforcement officer. Where's my mental? How do I handle a mental patient? One of the biggest, worst ass whoopings I got on the street was stopping a guy that I thought was drunk. He was kept stepping out in traffic during rush hour in West Virginia. And the guy had, I didn't know it till later. He just gotten out of the state hospital, mental hospital. And he ran his hands down his pockets while I was talking to him. I asked him to pull his hands out. He pulled out two handfuls of rocks and threw him and hit me with these rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So when I put him up the wall, you know, on the wall to bring his, you know, how you go under their arms and you grab their wrist and bring them down to cuff them. I got down to about the middle of his body and he's like, I'm not going any further. Man, yeah, was strong as a freaking ox.
That's great when they comply until they don't.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny because we went back and listened to the tapes, and I'm out here fighting this old guy. And I had split his head wide open during the fight, and I got one cuff on him, and the other one jammed. And now I'm thinking, crap, if I let go of him, he's going to kill me with my own handcuffs. Yeah. We went back and listened to the tape, and there's numerous people calling in saying, you better get this young cop out here some help. He's getting his ass kicked all over the street. This and that man's going to kill you, the little white officer out here. You know,
I'm sure they got replayed a couple times.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that for years afterwards. But
right. I'm going to tell you this. If you're a police officer and you haven't had your ass whipped, you're not a police officer.
You're not doing your job. It's scary. There's a lot of times it's scary, but. You know, I believe that the good Lord gave us the ability to control our fear. It's okay to be scared, but you just can't let the fear overwhelm you, or you won't be able to think logically, and you're going to get yourself or someone else hurt. So that's my psychology class for the day.
General George S. Patton said, all men are frightened. The more intelligent they are, the more frightened they are.
There you go.
You know, so it's the thing is, you know, courage is being afraid. Anyway.
Yep. So... tell us, I don't know, what was the, say, the most successful case you guys did in Expo? What were the results of all your efforts and all those long hours?
I could tell you some really cool run and gun stories and that kind of stuff, but I'll tell you the thing that I'm extremely proud of, because it counters the narrative that I believe exists in the country today. After, you know, 2014 and on, from Ferguson, Missouri on, okay, but... You know, they try to make it seem like the police are just a machine out there targeting and killing minorities. And that's not at all the case. Never been my experience. I don't believe any of it. I've looked at the stats extensively, and you and I both know what statistics are. They're whatever you want them to be.
Yep.
You can tell any story through numbers that you want to. But if you're honest and you look at the number of shootings and killings and that kind of stuff in the country, police killing anybody isn't even really a blip on the radar, and police killing minorities is even not even a blip in that blip. So, but in Expo, for 11 months, we took 93 guns off the street in 11 months, and we didn't shoot any. We had no officer involved shootings. And this was not, we'd stop. Some of them were stop them, get them out of the car, and there's a gun underneath the seat. But a lot of them were guns in waistbands, guns in pockets, hands on, get it done quick. Because we were never afraid to go hands on. And I think where a lot of these, this is going to sound horribly insulting, and I don't mean it that way, but the non-confrontational policing that occurs now, because cops are afraid to put their hands on people now. Because back when I was policing, if we got in trouble, you get fired. Now you get indicted. So, I don't know that I would sign up and do the same things that I did back when, because I had support of my sergeant, chief, mayors, and the things you talked about. But we took 97 guns off of the streets, directly off of people, and we didn't have to shoot anybody because we got to them before they could pull their guns and force us into a situation where that kind of violence. And I only say that to say we were so proficient and confident that we had the support of our leadership that we could do that, and that prevented shootings. Now it's that hesitation and stuff like that. I don't know if you do it, but I'm a super cop nerd, so I read a lot of public information of police involved shootings, and I read and I try to break down, why did this happen? How did this happen? And a lot of it is the hesitation on officers' part. And I'm not second guessing. I try not to. Hindsight's 2020, but if I wasn't there, I really don't have an opinion on it, but I read about it. So I go and say it to myself. But in a lot of those situations, it's because they're hesitant to get in there fast to prevent it getting to the ultimate, the escalation of having to use your firearm.
Right. Right.
As far as Expo's success goes, I think that's the biggest one. We had some great, when Rufus Brown picked up Josh Hunt and used him as a battering ram to get into the house that the bad guys were running into. That was a great one.
Did he use his head or what?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Back of his head, shoulders, everything, right through the door. It was great. It was that one, in the time our sergeant, because they were starting to get used to us because we were in these bright yellow shirts. So you'd see a black guy and a white guy in yellow shirts. They knew immediately. It didn't matter what kind of car we were in. Sometimes we were in marked, sometimes we were unmarked. But as soon as you see that combination, it's the cops coming. So we're like, all right. So in Savannah, we had paddy wagons, transport vans that there's no windows in the back. There's the cage and that kind of stuff. Everybody in the neighborhood sees the wagon come through. They know, that's just a transport. That's not really even a patrol, or so they thought. Uh-huh. So we loaded up in the back of that van, and Sarge drove. The guys that would usually run before we got to the block were looking, oh, it's just that. And when we unloaded that cargo out on the, 8 gorillas jumping out on the corners, man, it was a sight to behold, but very effective. That's how we learned, The bad guys got better, and we tried to adapt to it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you're out there playing chess, and it was a lot of fun, but that experience laid the basis for anything else I was trying to do. And I think the failure, if there was one, of a unit like Expo was we did not write down or gather the intelligence. I had, what my experience was, and my guys, all of our guys had the experiences that they had, but they took that intel with them, and it separated when the unit broke up. If we had written that down, done intel reports and formed some strategies, I think it would have served us very well, because, 4 years later, when I got on the ATF task force, that's the intel that I used to start Operation Ruffian. Was all from intel that I had from 4 years ago. And one of the chapters, same guys, same place, doing the same shit.
Yep. Yep. It's so just for our listeners here, especially those that are not familiar with law enforcement operations, the whole purpose of Expo is to take violence off the street and protect law-abiding citizens. This is not where you're going to go out and crack people's heads because they call you a pig. You know, if things like that bother you, you don't need to be a police officer because people are going to call you everything in the book. It's words. Words don't hurt you. If your feelings are getting hurt, go pick a different occupation. But yeah. I want to ask you a question, Kevin. When you signed on in law enforcement, did you sign on to go kill people?
Hell no.
Exactly. Exactly.
Quite the contrary. And Murph, I know you're asking that really, but I mean, you know, I the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. I signed up because I wanted to help people. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be productive. Like I said, protect the people who can't protect themselves. Yep. That was, you know, always my goal to keep people from being hurt. First time in police land, didn't see too much because Windsor was a quiet town. But Baghdad, you know, we patrolled there and I saw violence on a scale that I didn't grow up around that. You know, we didn't have shootings in Windsor, Connecticut. We didn't have that kind of stuff. There was, you know, one stabbing when I was a senior in high school involving one of my best friends and another friend of mine. It ended tragically, but it was stupid, you know, but violence was not a problem in the community that I grew up in. So I had to, through sport, seek out that type of physical confrontation. But Baghdad was a whole different thing. That was violence on a scale that, you know, life-changing. You're around it, you hear it, you feel it, you smell it. The most incredible and terrible thing I saw was on August 19th, 2003, when they bombed the United Nations building. I was there 10 minutes before the explosion and 5 minutes after. So, you know, to see casualties on a mass scale like that, it really changes your perspective of what violence is. And, you know, again, having fancied myself as a tough guy and stuff, I never wanted to inflict that kind of pain or injury on anybody.
Right.
You know, as a matter of fact, I made it my mission in life to try and make sure nobody inflicted that on anybody. Mm-hmm. Didn't work out exactly, but you know, if you don't have guys out there trying to stop it, it's never going to stop.
Right. And the reason I asked you that question is because that's what I preach that on here. Every police officer I ever met in my entire life, I think, except that very minuscule few that go rogue, joined law enforcement for the same reason, to help people, not to kill people, but to help them, protect them, change their tires, carry their groceries, whatever it might be. And this show, when Morgan and I started it, we started with this: nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop.
Amen.
When there's a bad cop around, we will call them out every single time because they've sullied the reputation of every good police officer, not only in the United States, but around the world. So just, you know, our regular listeners have heard that time and time again, that, you know, we join law enforcement to help others. And you've been in the mix. And that's, so our listeners know, I didn't tell Kevin I was going to ask him that question. You saw you heard a natural reaction just there. So that's what law enforcement's about.
The biggest thing about that is nobody wants to be next to that guy.
And right.
I've talked about it tons of times. The thing is, we talk about our brotherhood, you know, and our friendship that's evolved from just in our post-law enforcement careers when, you know, you and I met, but it's the same mentality. There's a misconception that the thin blue line, you know, way back when, maybe there was a code of silence where cops don't rat on other cops, all that kind of stuff. I can't tell you how contrary that belief and that practice is in current law enforcement. Cops are chomping at the bit to be able to find a dirty cop to tell on them. And that's it, you know, it's almost become in vogue. Like if you can catch a dirty cop, it's bigger than catching Pablo Escobar.
Yeah.
You know, it's nobody covers for anybody, you know, we don't live in that society. It doesn't exist that way anymore because, you know, now everything's on YouTube, it's on body worn camera, it's on all of these things. So nobody's covering that stuff up. And the thing is, you know, I thank God never had to experience somebody that was a real dirty cop, you know, no excessive force, none of that kind of stuff. That was not welcome. You know, I remember having one conversation where perfectly legal, perfectly justified. But, you know, a buddy of mine got one extra shot in when the guy was in handcuffs, and we were all like, don't do that. Don't do mm-hmm. that around me. Don't do that. Don't do that again, because it's unnecessary. Okay. Mm-hmm. And once, yeah. you know, like you said, Murph, this is not personal. You know, I've been, pardon the expression, I've been motherfucked like up and down, you know, run, chased, fought, done all of those things. As soon as those cuffs were on and the resistance stopped, that was it. It was over. Then I'm picking them yeah. up, make sure they're okay. You know, that's yep. not, it's not a personal thing.
So after Expo was successful, why did they stop it? And then what'd you do next?
Politics. We got a new chief in. Then there was a politics. And now that's kind of my blanket answer. But to be honest with you, you can't run at that level with, you know, your Lou and I always talk about the RPMs. You know, when your RPMs mm-hmm. are in the red, pretty soon that engine's going to explode if you keep it way up there. So we did that for, you know, 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. And go, 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 go. After a while, it takes a toll on people. You know, we were all kind of, some of us got promoted out of the unit. Some people got burned out from it. And it was essentially time for it to end. So I got a call the last day at Expo saying, you still want to go upstairs? Meaning the detective's office? I'm like, yeah, they're like, they got a spot in homicide. So I was like, yes, going to homicide. Didn't happen there. Like, yeah, no, it was like carrot gone. So I went back to the downtown precinct, which, you know, I've always lived my life. And again, I had a very charmed career, like on the street for 4 months, got pulled for Expo, went back to the streets for a little while. I got pulled for an OCDEF task force. That's where I first met Lou, and his partner, Toby. They started an OCDEF case on, some gangs that were in the projects that I learned how to police in. So I knew everybody. I knew who the players were. I knew who their baby's mamas were. I knew the locations. I knew that. And they needed that. I mean, you know, the cooperation between feds and state and local, it's essential. They do the high level stuff, but you need the ground level stuff.
Absolutely.
And you need that intel. They just happened to be looking in the neighborhood that I was, intimately familiar with. So I wound up going back downtown for a couple months and then wound up on that task force. And I learned how to investigate, you know, so that was where I learned, not the run and gun stuff, the more pull the reins back, watch, you know, the old joke about the two bulls on the hill looking down over the herd of cows, you know, let's run down there and now let's walk down and take care of it all.
So yeah.
That was, you know, that was where I learned that lesson.
Yeah, and just for our listeners here, if you're not aware of OCDEF, it's the Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, a section of the Department of Justice. And when you say an OCDEF case, it's supposed to be the higher level cases, and it's in a task force environment, which means you bring in multiple agencies. And the best thing about OCDEF is they will give you dedicated funding for your investigations. You've got to jump through some hoops to get it, but once you get it, it's a higher designated case for prosecutions. There's actually an assistant U.S. attorney in every U.S. attorney's office that's the OCDEF coordinator. So that's when you're hitting those level cases, that's your higher level cases, just for a little education there.
And, now, and forgive me, because I'm an Army guy and acronyms are like my life.
Well, we all are like that. And that's that was one thing Morgan started and I like is when there's an acronym, we ask our guests to explain it. But I was the director of the OCDEF Fusion Center for the last few years before retiring from law enforcement, and have a very intimate knowledge of the whole organization.
No, and after Expo, that's really where I made my bread and butter was OCDEF cases in mm-hmm. when I was assigned to narcotics and all these different things. But that was where I met all the guys you and I know in common. But that was where I learned how the machine works. You can't cure all the problems from the street level. You can't cure all the problems from the top level. You all have to work together and hit all the points in between. The right. guys at the way top has to listen to the guys at the bottom, and the guys at the bottom have to listen to the guys at the top, and developing those relationships, putting your ego aside and sharing your expertise, but being open-minded enough to recognize other people's expertise is that was, you know, invaluable in my development as an investigator.
It makes a team that's undefeatable. It can't be beat. How about that?
Yeah, no, if you have the, again, the right people in the right spots, you can do so much.
So now the ATF task force, is that where you're getting into Operation Ruffian?
No, that was this was Operation Raging Waters again. So I had no investigative experience when Raging Waters started. I was, you know, patrolman, got assigned to the Crime Suppression Expo unit, but I hadn't written search warrants. I hadn't done any of that kind of stuff, but I understood the concept of controlled buys and that kind of stuff. And again, I knew the neighborhood. So this, there was one summer, I think 2007, where three gangs on the east side of Savannah were responsible for, I believe, 70% of the violent crime in the city that summer.
Wow.
So they were obviously the target single, but gun shootings, drugs, you know, the typical Savannah story, unfortunately. But I had come up and learned how to police in the housing project that where one of the gangs went, but also the neighborhoods were so close. So I knew a lot of the guys from the other gangs too. So I was pulled in because I had a lot of intelligence. I used to put everything in my PowerPoints, you know, this is Gwinnett Street, this is Hitch Village, this guy is this. And I used to keep tabs on all of that stuff. So when I was asked, like, hey, what do you know about so-and-so? I turned that over to my sergeant and they said, nah, come on, come with us. We're going to need you, which was awesome. You know, again, right place, right time, given an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was the success of that operation?
We solved, there was a murder of a pretty significant murder. He's a basically kilo level drug trafficker, but gang leader. He was murdered, and that started a war between all of these things. So we were able to recover a lot of the weapons that were used in a couple of murders, you know, took some really bad guys off the street. And I think as far as success goes, you know, all of them were convictions. So, you know, we definitely got the right guys because every door we kicked in, there were guns and that kind of stuff. And I used to love getting drugs. Drugs was awesome. You know, when you go and there's a cookie, a crack in there and you're like, yeah, that was great. It was rewarding, but nothing was more satisfying than getting a gun because, you know, Lou and I have talked about it extensively. You get a gun off the street, you don't know what you prevented. You don't know how many lives you saved. You don't know. You're taking away a really effective tool for a bad guy to use to hurt somebody, and getting that away from you, it's you can't count the number of people that were not hurt because you got that gun away.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. You know, even at that first Operation Expo, where you took 93 guns off the street, people might think, when in a scheme of things, of the millions of guns are out there, it's a drop in the bucket. But
Savannah's not like a very big town.
Yeah. And 93 guns, that's huge. I mean, that's huge. I got excited when we would do a drug case and you got one gun because you know somebody's going to get an extra 5 years federal prison for it.
924C, catch them with the dope. Woohoo.
Yes, sir. That's what it was all about. So from that operation, did you have to go back to patrol, or what was your next assignment?
Yeah. I remember the chief came in and talked about it. Now, he decided that the OCDF case was over. He hadn't informed the case agent from the ATF. So the operation kept going. Our involvement went, but I'll never forget. He's sitting there telling everybody. So there's everybody that's important in my life, right? There's my chief, my deputy chief, all the majors. There were a bunch of special agents in charge from all the alphabet. They're all in this presentation, which I wound up giving because I had the PowerPoint. Here's the people we arrested. Here's the cases we've made. Here's the guns we've recovered, the drugs we've recovered, all this kind of stuff. And I give the presentation. And at the end of it, the chief goes, hey, you know, it's been a successful operation. It's great for everybody except Grogan because he's going back to the street. I was like, we couldn't have talked about this before?
What was that little bump in the rear end there?
Yeah, no, but that was kind of the writing on the wall for me when I left the Savannah-Chatham Police Department, because we had I was temporarily assigned to our counter-narcotics team, and I really did not like the way they did business. I had a lot of experience on them. When I would make a drug case, you know, if you get a certain amount of drugs, you would call in the narcotics team and they would take it from there. I had a real issue with the way they did it. It was really kind of sneaky and sleazy, and I didn't like it. I saw some of their interviews and the way they operated. And I'm not saying unethical. I'm just saying very different stylistically than my style of policing. So I was like, no, it was not good. So I never wanted to go work over there, but I got the temporary assignment. And then so everybody naturally assumed, like, he's going to apply to C&T. And That was not going to happen. So I wound up, Lou Velozzi and Toby Taylor introduced me to a guy named Al Cato. It's not to be confused with the terrorist organization, but he was running the Mace Drug Task Force out in Liberty and Long County, which is southwest of Savannah. So I went and worked for him for a little while, and Cato was a great guy. You know, he was the captain over the narcotics team, but he's a longtime investigator in Hinesville, old school Southern cop. Yeah. And I walked into his office and I said, look, and he's like, yeah, look, Toby and Lou said, you're good. So you're good enough with me. Handed me my badge and my gun. And he said, go get it. That was my training as a narcotics investigator.
And what agency was that? Is that still Savannah?
Mace. Yeah. So I technically worked for the Liberty County Sheriff's Department, but I was assigned to the Mace Drug Task Force, which was the multi-agency crack enforcement drug task force.
Based out of where?
Hinesville, Georgia. Yeah, so Liberty and Long County. It was a multi county. So I was sworn as Liberty County and Long County by both sheriffs. They swore us in, and we worked kind of multi county jurisdiction.
How close to Savannah is that?
About a 45-minute ride southwest.
Do the counties touch each other?
No, nope. There's one county in between.
Okay,
but not very big. So I worked as far as like the Fed stuff. And again, I got into more organized crime, drug enforcement task force stuff while I was out in there. And Cato has every connection. If there was anything going on in Southeast Georgia, you wanted to talk to Al Cato because he knew if he didn't know what you were looking for, he knew somebody who could get it for you. And, wow. And you know, just a dedicated professional, great guy. Don't
Those
tell him I said anything
mines.
Nice about him. Yeah. No, that's and he was absolutely that. He's everything. I think every state has one, but they only have one or two because there are not many guys like that around, but a national treasure, an absolute treasure.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
So how did you get into Operation Ruffian?
Well, so I was out at Mace, and I worked, I was working, just my regular narcotics duties. Then I started to identify a gang out there. While I was identifying that gang, as I'm learning, you know, the who's who of criminals out in Liberty and Long County, Lou and Toby had a storefront out in Statesboro. So Statesboro Blues. So I got involved in that. I learned about storefront operations all the while I'm writing my OCDEF proposal for the gang that's in the rural stuff out in Liberty and Long County. So I worked out with the FBI, and I hate to say that word. Forgive my language. But I worked with those guys in the DEA because Toby and Lou were tied up on the storefront. So they couldn't very well work an OCDEF case where I was at, but I'm going back and forth. I'm doing drugs and controlled buys and doing search warrants. And then that's what I'm doing in the day. And at night I'm going to cover in the cover room, of the storefront out in Statesboro. So again, absolutely, in the mix, but let me tell you, talk about learning. I told you I had no investigative experience, when I left Savannah, when they made Willie Lovett, who was chief, he was interim chief. They hired a guy from L.A. He came in. I left Savannah. Then they made Willie Lovett the actual chief after the guy from L.A. washed out. And as soon as Lovett went back, I went back to Savannah. I was back in Savannah again. They put me in patrol in the West Chatham precinct, which is like the country. I was lost. I locked up like two cows and a mule. But they all had guns on them, I might add.
Well, as long as you're earning your money.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I was out of my element a little bit, except the Carver Heights neighborhood, which is very close to the city. And I had some experience there on Expo, but lots of guns, lots of gangs, lots of drugs going on in that neighborhood. So I'm back in West Chatham for 2 months. And Toby calls me up and said, "Hey, man, I want to put something together. You got anything going on?" And I had just started to see the writing on the wall, literally graffiti in the neighborhood. See, you know, CVT, VBS. I see all these markings on the walls and in the streets and that kind of stuff. So I'm like, what's going on here? Really started to look at that. Toby calls me, wants to start something up. He's like, "Do you got anything?" I said, "Matter of fact, I'm onto this thing." So I start talking to him about that for a day. And my sergeant, who's my sergeant on Expo, was working in the intelligence center, working gun cases.
Mm-hmm.
He calls me up and says, "Hey, man, I'm trying to put something together. Do you have anything going on?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I do."
Hey,
and
again, all right.
Everything aligned, and that's when Ruffian began.
And tell us, how did you pick Ruffian, the name?
Ruffian? That's a great story. I love that one. So
I read it. I know what the answer is.
Yeah, no, it was really cool. So, like I said, one of the markings in the graffiti they were writing was the Carver Village Thoroughbreds. So, you know, I'm thinking Stallions in the neighborhood, like sports team was the Stallions and all, but I'm thinking Thoroughbreds and that kind of stuff. So we get going into it and I'm like, so I'm sort of a horse racing enthusiast. And in the 70s, you know, back when you were in your 40s, Murph.
Thank you. You've been talking to Morgan again, haven't you?
Yeah. But Ruffian was an absolute champion filly. She was a, and you know, it's only the geldings and stallions that run in the Kentucky Derby and Preakness and Belmont and all that. But Ruffian was a just famed racehorse back, I think 1974 was when she hit her heyday, but she won every race she ever ran. Wow. And she was legendary for her heart and drive. She just loved to run. The tragic ending of that story was they ran a stakes race. So they put her, who was the best filly in the world, versus the best stallion in the world at the time. And when they were running, she broke her leg while she was racing. So they put her down and they had to like fight with her. They had to, you know, sedate her. They get her back into get her off the infield into the stable, and they're trying to repair her leg. Well, the sedative wore off and she thought she was still racing. So she runs. And of course, it's in a small space. She damages her leg even more to where they can't repair it. And they had to put her down. But Ruffian comes from her spirit, you know, it's kind of a tip of the hat to her, no quit. I'm not stopping. There's no way you're going to beat me style of racing. So that was why we tipped the cap, you know, the thoroughbred connection there. And that was where Ruffian came from. Not to mention, we were dealing with some ruffians.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your book, so the name of this particular book is Ruffian, Ruffian. And it went on for, how long did that operation last?
2 years.
Are basically going after the gang members, the most violent folks in the Savannah area.
Yeah. And the way we did it was, it wasn't so much, you know, that you're chasing bad guys. That was different. It was the way we went at it. We involved the community. Like everybody's talking about community policing and all that kind of stuff. Police departments, city governments, all that kind of stuff. They're pretty big on saying, here's what your problem is and here's how we're going to fix it. We didn't do that. We went to the people in the neighborhood and said, what are your problems? And they told us. So the first half of it was, you know, is a full blown counterinsurgency. That was what we were doing. We were going in, embedding ourselves and learning who's who, what's what. Again, I had some experience in the neighborhood, so I knew the hot spots. I knew where the hot corners were and that kind of stuff. And that was easy to look up statistically. But having ridden in a patrol car around there for a couple of months, I saw a lot of, okay, this is that. And but what we did was we did a very overt thing. We handed out flyers. We put up a billboard. We're like, look, the feds are in the neighborhood. We're coming to clean this up. So, you know, take your crime committing asses someplace else, which surprisingly, they did not. So we did a lot of what I call handshaking and baby kissing. You know, we sat down with the NAACP and told them what we were going to do. We sat down with the neighborhood association, told them what we were going to do. We sat down with the mayor and told him what we were going to do. You know, we went in there and tried to do things a very nice way, talking to folks, while at the same time We started working informants, started mm-hmm. buying dope, started doing search warrants on all these things. So now you see us out there cleaning up graffiti, saying, hey, same guys now. You know, it's me and Toby out there saying, hey, we're going to clean this graffiti and do all this nice stuff. And then the next morning, we're kicking in your local drug dealer's door.
Yeah, there's a, and I'm looking, I marked this one passage in your book. The larger and more complex a drug investigation gets, like anything else, the more areas there are for things to go wrong. What we used to say in DEA is big cases, big problems, little cases, little problems, no cases, no problems.
Yeah, always a problem. You just got to figure out how to circumvent, you know.
Exactly. Well, you, and if you do your job professionally, it gets done. So I was going to ask you, but I mean, you mentioned that you guys really capitalize through informants. So give our listeners an idea of how's a white boy like you go into these black neighborhoods and recruit informants? Why would they trust you, man? You're known.
Gift the gab, baby. Gift the gab. You know, the thing is, you know, the streets are anywhere. It doesn't really matter. And a lot of people like to make the race thing because, you know, a white boy from Connecticut walking around the housing projects of deep south Savannah, Georgia, it's all how you talk to people. I remember one time I was feeling myself pretty good. I get out of my patrol car. I'm walking through the projects, and I see three guys just sitting on a stoop on a summer day. You know, and I walk past them, and they're just mean mugging me, you know, just looking at me.
Yeah.
All kinds of crazy. Well, you've met me, Murph. I have a tough time biting my tongue. So I just turned to him and said, I was like, what's the matter, man? Y'all ain't never seen a white boy in the projects before? And their response was simply, yeah, but their response was simply said, not by yourself. So they either thought I was the toughest dude in the world or crazy, or maybe it's communicating. I can sum it up very easily. And it's not something you can learn in a police academy. It's not something you can learn at sensitivity training or ethics training or stuff like that. It's just being a decent person. Talk to people like they matter. And they will respond the same way. They will treat you with the same amount of respect that you show them. And that's exactly where, right. So, you know, there was a little bit of a hurdle with the whole race thing, but that's overcome in my experience very easily by just being a decent and respectful human being.
There was I hate to keep interjecting my stories on your one, it's your interview, but I was in Salisbury, North Carolina. This young man was dealing kilos of crack, and we were targeting in on him, and just we were making small inroads. But you know, just I wanted to get the guy. What I wanted to do was flip him because I wanted his source. So we found out he was at an informant's house, and I went into the informant's house and I said, "Where is he?" And he's in the back bedroom. He's back there playing one of the video games, the basketball game. So I didn't say a word. I just walked in and sat down next to him on the bed. Picked up the other controller and didn't know shit about this basketball game, but started interfering with his basketball game. And it goes on for like 3 or 4 minutes and he's not saying anything, but I can see him out of the corner of my eye. He's giving me the sneak eye every once in a while. And finally he looks over, he's like, "What the fuck you want, Murphy? What are you doing in there?" And I just came over to talk, man. Just see how you're doing. We'll see what you do all day long. You know, I'm trying to learn how to play this basketball game. And it's just small talk, but that, like you said, the mutual respect rather than going in and saying, "Look, some USOB, I know what you're doing. I know that you're dealing." He knows he's dealing drugs. I don't need to tell him that. And he knows that I know. But we ended up, we actually flipped the guy. But then, of course, he went, like any typical CI, he went rogue again and we had to put him in jail eventually. But respect level gets you a lot of mileage.
No, for sure. And the thing is, the consequence of that is that, you know, if you're a caring human being and that respect is genuine, when you're talking to these guys, and I call them kids because, you know, I'm talking about guys that are anywhere between 18 and 30, you know, they're out here doing their business and they take their profession just every bit as serious as I took mine. And I would talk to them and you develop an affection for guys that you deal with, on a regular basis, especially if it's that at that level of respect where they know what you're doing, you know what they're doing, they know you know what they're doing, and then your only recourse is to put them in prison if they don't stop. There's one story in that book about a kid. I think I call him Midget in the book, which is not mm-hmm. his real name, but I went to him beforehand, and I knew him when he was when I was on Expo, he was the fastest little shit you've ever chased. And, you know, but funny kid, memorable. And when I go back in all these years later, there he is on the same corner doing the same thing. And I said, look, man, you got to stop. Oh, no, it's not me. It's not me. I said, look, man, you got to stop. No, it's not me. You know, people put my name and stuff. I said, listen, dude, I said, I'm just going to tell you flat out. If you don't stop, the only thing I can do is put you in prison. All right. But it ain't me. I'm like, okay. Well, it wound up being him. You know, he wound up getting a significant prison sentence for selling crack in one of the most violent neighborhoods in Savannah. But yeah. To his credit, once he got sentenced, we were leaving the sentencing, and the U.S. Marshal was going to put him in cuffs. And he stopped the marshal. He said, can you give me 1 second? And the marshal kind of looked at him crazy. And he reached his hand out, shake my hand. He said, hey, man, you tried to tell me. He's like, I should have listened to you. Wow. And that was, you know, a huge thing for me where I knew, like, I can sleep at night knowing I did the right thing. You know, I did right by the kid. He wasn't a bad person. He's a good dude, smart guy doing dumb things.
Yeah.
You know, and we can talk about the reasons why, you know, good people do dumb things. And I'm a decent person. I've done a lot of dumb shit in my life. Just thankfully it hasn't caused me any prison time, you know?
We all do, but there was, and I think that's the same guy that you describe in your book about his upbringing, that he knows about crack because that's what his mom and dad taught him, and he never went to school. And I mean, I think he wrote in there, even when he would go to McDonald's, he couldn't read the menu. So whoever was in front of him, whatever they ordered, he'd say, I'll take the same thing.
Yeah. No, it's scary. So there's about three different guys kind of wrapped up into that story. But yeah, you know, but that conversation after there was a huge car chase, and we go, we have him only on drug charges, but he's involved in a bunch of things. And we sat down, and when he broke that down for me, like, it changed. It really, for lack of a better term, it really screwed me up, because I was thinking, you know, here we go. We're putting this guy in prison, but now I understand where he's coming from. And I thought, I really did. I thought at that time I knew and was kind of sensitive to those things, but I wasn't at all. I was, you know, let's lock him up. These guys are drug dealers. Let's lock him up. I wasn't looking at the reasons why, again, because that was not my purpose. My purpose was he's committing crime in this area, and I have to address that. And that's what I did. But again, as a decent human being, when I look at why is he dealing crack, it wasn't because it was the cool thing to do. It's because that's what that dude learned. That's what that guy knew. And the last guy that didn't even have the basic life skills to order from McDonald's, that kid was deadly. He was the one that was one of the most dangerous humans I've ever met.
Wow. Well, we're coming towards the end of our conversation. You had a little rough ending on your career. And then for our listeners, I asked Kevin, was it okay to talk about this? And he says, there's nothing to hide in his life. So just, you know, give us the Reader's Digest of what happened.
Well, the long and short of it is, you know, and this is a point, you know, you and I have talked about before, and Lou and I have talked about it extensively. And I think I've talked in the last 10 years, I've talked to so many people about it, is I fancied myself as a tough guy, so much so that I never addressed a lot of the issues. You know, I learned about death at a very, very early age. And then I learned about death even more so overseas in a massive scale. And then, you know, I worked a couple of years in homicide in Savannah and saw more death than I ever wanted to see there, you know, young lives ending. But I just pushed it all down, and I actually drank it all down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my drinking had gotten way out of control, and I wound up involved in a DUI, 100%, 1,000% guilty. You know, I had been drinking all day, and then decided, you know, I was going to get my car ready for the next day because I was working a gang case, and as I'm driving to go refuel, I got in an accident, and very thankfully, the woman that I hit was not injured seriously, and I got dinged up, but, you know, nothing too serious. But that ended my career, essentially, and no excuse for it other than I just didn't deal with the problems that I knew were there, and I avoided them for years, and it caught up with me. So, you know, the drinking got me, but that turned into an absolute fiasco. And, you know, that's the way of the world these days. But, you know, as far as what caused it and what did it is just, I thought I was too cool to ask for help. I didn't deal with it, and it cost me dearly. So now I spend a lot of time talking to folks saying, hey, it's okay to not be all right. It's not okay to not address it.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to bring it up. This is not intended to embarrass you whatsoever. It's just to show that you've taken a terrible situation and you just did say, F the world, you know, I did this for them and this is the way they treated me. Even though you lost the career that you loved, you're still going forward trying to help others. And that's one of the things we're really focusing on here on the Game of Crimes is the wellness programs in law enforcement as well as the military programs now. Because there's way too many suicides in both, especially our military veterans. You know, these young bucks coming on and wanting to be the tough guys. Listen to the old farts, you know, because we've been there and we've done it. I didn't, when my partner was shot in 89, I never went for counseling. And since 1989, I had dreams about his shooting, not nightmares. I just had dreams about him until the day I retired from DEA in 2013. So for 24 years, I had dreams about him, just reliving. I'm not PTSD or anything like that. I just relived the shooting over and over because it was my partner. And it was all because I was stupid enough to think I was a tough guy and didn't need counseling. So thank you very much for being transparent and telling that story. But I want to know, you know, tell our listeners what you're doing now.
I don't know, Murph. I have no idea what I'm doing now. You know, I know take it day.
Things you're doing.
I take it day by day. I enjoy the hell out of it. I try to, like you're saying, I try to be a help to folks that, you know, I speak to a lot of younger cops and some soldiers, you know, to try and direct them in the path of, look, if you need help, there's always people to talk to because, you know, how many suicides have you seen? You know what I mean? It's just, yeah. It's God awful. So if there's anything I can do to prevent that, I do. But, you know, that's kind of something I do. I guess you'd call it a hobby. What I do mostly now is I'm writing two more books. I've written a couple screenplays, trying to get some funding to get some films made. You know, Lou's having tremendous success with his show coming out. I just want to give him a plug on Investigative ID, and I believe it's on HBO Max. His show is called Operation Undercover, and it goes into his storefront style investigations and undercover gun and drug buys and stuff like that. But, you know, we started podcasting. That's when we met. Mm-hmm. But that really got me into writing. It really, you know, the first book I wrote was very cathartic. I was waiting to go to court on all my DUI stuff. So I sat down and started writing that, which led to Ruffian, which led to I'm calling it Dome Rocker. It's written about my time in homicide. And the coolest project I'm working on, the one I'm really excited about, is I'm writing a biography of a local rap phenom here out of Savannah. It was called Quando Rondo. But he grew up in the projects that I policed. And, mm-hmm. you know, I know his family. But his real name's Tyquan Bowman. And he represents everything that I would have wished for any of those kids that grew up in the projects where I was working. Because, you know, he's got a gift and was able to do something with it. Now, he's having legal troubles and stuff like that. So I'm working as a private investigator in his case to try and help him out as best I can with his situation. But, you know, to see a talented young kid have a way out of what he grew up in, I think that's cathartic for me also to try and where the answer is not putting people in jail when the answer is actually helpful to the kid. You know, it means a lot to me to be able to do it. And he's a super interesting guy. So writing his biography has been a lot of fun.
Nice. So your books, the books I have are Black Sheep, White Cop, Savannah Exposed. And then the latest book, Ruffian. And here's the cool thing, everybody, about Ruffian is Kevin wrote this book, and the foreword is written by retired ATF agent Chris Bayless. We call him Chrisser, who was a guest here on Game of Crimes, episode 42, back in March 28th of 22. Chris is an unbelievable human being. We were talking about him before we started the recording, Kevin and I, and Lou's the same way. This guy in our book walks on water, and here's a testament to him. You know, he's the guy that put Mel Chancy in federal prison, the president of the Hells Angels in Chicago. Chris put him in jail working undercover. They are best friends now. at some point down the road, we're going to have Mel on the show. I've gotten to be friends with him. He's living a Christian lifestyle. Never, this is weird, and you're going to understand it, though. Never in a million years did I think I would ever invite a former president or any member of the Hells Angels or any other outlaw motorcycle gang to come and sleep in my house. And I invited Mel and his wife to come to Orlando. He's coming to a conference here in a couple months. And what a gracious guy. He's, you know, he's got a hotel. They're paying for his hotel room and everything. And he's going to do that. So we're going to get together for breakfast the next morning before he leaves.
Well, there's only one Mel Chancy. So it doesn't, you know, what an amazing human being. And again, you know, when we talk about our circle of friends, our brothers, it's an all-star list. I'm honored to be anywhere near it or around it. But Mel's super great guy. But Chris is a guy I looked up to, you know, from afar. He was in Chicago, but he would bounce back and come in, do parts on cases with Lou. And so I would meet him through that and see it. But then I would touch base on him. If I was working a gang case, I'd call him, hit him up for an idea on that. And he, just his brain and the way he would come up with things. Like if I couldn't figure something out, if I didn't have one answer, Chrisser had 32.
Yeah.
One of the most humble humans. Yeah, no, one of the most humble professionals, caring human being. I mean, just a really, really good guy. So when I was writing this one, you know, Lou had just released his book, Storefront Sting. You know, so Chrisser and I had bumped into each other, and I said, you know what, dude? I said, I'll take a swing. It would be like asking somebody of your stature to write a forward. You know, guys who are super accomplished, and Chrisser probably being the most accomplished that I got to work hand in hand with, even just a little bit. But I asked him, I said, hey, you know, Chrisser, would you consider? I said, I don't know if you're thinking about writing books or anything like that, but maybe I was trying to pitch it to him like I was doing him a favor. I said, you know, maybe you could get your name on something. If you could write the foreword for this book, I'd really appreciate it. And he's like, no problem, man. You know, just the way Chrisser does, it was effortless and nice. And the way he pulled it off, you know, it was just, it's such an honor to have his name on my book. And the fact that he and you are not afraid to attach your names to a guy like me, you know, means the world to me, because not a perfect human being. I've made mistakes, but I've done everything I can to try and overcome those mistakes. I think the best thing you can do, especially in law enforcement, is you make a mistake, own it. Own it.
Yep,
take exactly. Responsibility. That's law enforcement and anything else in life. But in law enforcement, for whatever reason, it's almost like you instantly, people's reflexes to cover your tracks. Don't cover your tracks. Own what you did. Take responsibility and you'll be all right. Nothing you did, I guarantee you, nothing you did was bad enough to warrant, you know, excommunication or whatever.
Right.
But again, the fact that a guy like Steve Murphy or Chris Bayless or Lou Velozzi take the time to sit down and talk with me, man, it means the world. You know, I'm a huge fan of yours and not the books and the podcast and all that kind of stuff, because that goes without saying. Great book, great podcast. But what you've done for this country and what you did for this country and what you continue to do for guys like me and guys that are coming behind us, you know, the guys that we'll probably never meet. They're going to know your name because of what you've done. And to call you a friend and brother is one of the greatest honors that I've ever had. So I appreciate it greatly and dearly, and I love you, bro.
Damn, I'm glad we don't have this on video because I'm blushing over here. Jeez, man. You know, and the same holds true here, brother. It's and I know I don't know if our listeners get tired of me talking about the law enforcement culture. It's what I know. And right here is a perfect example. My door is always open to you and your family. If you want to come to Orlando and get the hell away from Lou for a while, everybody will understand that.
We're coming down to see the Savannah Ghost Pirates play your Orlando Solar Bears, ECHL hockey. So we got to make that happen, Murph, because I love it.
Yes, sir. I know jack crap about hockey, but, you know, growing up in Tennessee as a little kid, my dad used to take me to Nashville to watch a hockey game, ice hockey game. I think this is the South. We don't play ice hockey down here. But look at what Florida Panthers are doing right now.
You look at the Florida Panthers, who, by the way, so our Savannah Ghost Pirates, been in the league 2 years now. We just signed to be the Florida Panthers affiliate today. So that was just announced today. So that's a super cool thing. But yeah, the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Florida Panthers, you got all of these minor league teams here in Orlando and Jacksonville and down in Fort Myers. Everblades just won the Kelly Cup, which is the ECHL championship. So to see the amount of success that hockey's having in the South, it's great. But it's the best live sport to go see. There's no, I don't think there's a question.
I like it. Brother, I can't thank you enough, Kevin. Everybody, again, this is Kevin Grogan. We call him Bootsy. You got to check out his books, Ruffian, Black Sheep, White Cop. You can find him on the IMDb on the internet where he's writing his screenplays. He's got it going on. He's still trying to help law enforcement. You were such a positive force on so many people in Savannah. One thing we didn't even mention was how you lined up the Public Works Department to come out and haul trash off and mow grass. And there's one part in your book where you talk about one of the neighbors looks at you like you said, y'all can take care of that nasty lot across the street. And he looks at you like, yeah, you and what army? And lo and behold, by the afternoon, you got the Public Department, you know, Public Works people out there cleaning things up in this neighborhood. And here was a man that just doesn't have a lot, but he was proud of his property. He just didn't like having that nasty thing across the street. So I can't say enough good things about you. The legacy that you left in Savannah Police, you showed people how you could be successful in a violent community to protect those who need to be protected. If there's ever anything I could do for you, you know how to get a hold of me, man. I mean, I can't wait for you to come to town and we'll go have some fun. And, thank you so much for being on Game of Crimes.
No, thanks for having me again. It's my honor. And, you know, for those of you listening there, you know, those books that I wrote, they're just, they are very straightforward, not intellectual pieces, but if you want to know what it's like to be a police officer on the street, they're as honest as they come.
Yep. And we didn't get into the part about the politics, but you can read it for yourself there, because the other things were more important to me talking to Kevin than that was. So, Kevin, if you will stand by just for a minute here, we'll finish up. And all the listeners out there, stand by for the debrief. Wow. Now that's what I call one fantastic, dedicated, and focused investigator. Someone who isn't afraid to go out in the roughest parts of a dangerous city, get to know the people there, good and bad, and then come up with ideas on how to reduce violent crime, drugs, gang activity, and make it a safer place. Did you guys notice how Kevin didn't take credit for what he did? You didn't hear him say, oh, hey, this was my idea. We're going to do it my way. He knew he needed others who had expertise and experience in areas he didn't, that knew the people in other areas of the city, that had people and physical skills that he didn't. You heard him giving much credit to the others, didn't you? And that's the way it should be. Law enforcement is a team effort, regardless of what agency you work for. As you heard today, and you've heard it in other episodes on Game of Crimes, there are some huge egos in law enforcement. Most people seem to have that type A personality, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, think about it. When going into a crime scene, a hostile situation, a place where people are angry and upset, you need these type A's who can get in there, get the situation calmed down and under control, right? Well, unfortunately, there are many law enforcement professionals who display that same attitude with other cops. They become territorial with investigations. They don't want to share information. They get upset when they don't get their way in an operation. And unfortunately, they hold grudges against other investigators and agencies. You know what? Sometimes they can work things out, but when they can't, who wins? Who do you think wins? The bad guys, the criminals, that's who. Kevin wasn't bragging about his successes here. In fact, you heard him talk about how the various sections contributed to the overall success of their operations. And you heard how proud he was of those successes. Not so much from a personal, look at me, look at what I did type position, but from the standpoint that, hey, this is my city, I'm proud of it, and I want everyone else to see and experience the great city of Savannah and Georgia. Experience the great city of Savannah, Georgia, and be safe at the same time. Now, even though Kevin has moved on from actively being involved in law enforcement, he still supports and loves what the brave men and women are doing to protect our citizens. At the same time, Kevin isn't bashful about expressing his opinions when the so-called leaders with the agencies, as well as the city and county governments, don't do their part to support law enforcement and the betterment of their homes, of their communities. He calls them out on it. He asks the hard questions. It takes some cojones to do that. He challenges them to stop being politicians, stop worrying about the next election, stop focusing on being popular in the polls, and step up and be the leader that you're supposed to be. Do the job that you were hired or elected to do, and do it for the citizens of their communities, not for themselves. Well, unfortunately, we hear too many stories of how these so-called leaders are more concerned about themselves and their future careers than they are about their constituents. As we all know, this isn't limited to just Savannah. It seems that we see this every time someone complains about a police action, about the cops doing their jobs. So many of the guests here on Game of Crimes have had to experience their leaders, their agencies, the local, state, and federal officials criticizing their actions. You know, hindsight's 20/20, right? So these are the people who I refer to as the pretty people. They're on board with them also. And by that, I mean movie stars, sports figures, singers, you name it. People who were blessed with a gift to do something that made them famous and wealthy, and now they think that wealth and fame have made them more important than the rest of us. That their mostly uninformed and unresearched opinions should be accepted and direct us to follow them, regardless of the truth. That just chaps my rear end. Their opinion seems to be, don't worry about the truth. They certainly didn't. Okay, time for me to get off my soapbox here. But as you can probably tell, this really infuriates me. Could you tell that? Okay. Oh, back to Kevin. As you heard, Kevin is now writing books. I'm proud of him. He's become a successful author. His books right now are Ruffian, that's the one I read, and Black Sheep, White Cop. And it talks about Savannah and some of the challenges they faced down there and some of the operations they worked on. You can find them on Amazon and other major book retailers, or you can go to the Game of Crimes webpage at the top. The webpage is gameofcrimespodcast.com. At the top, click on the book list, and you'll find a listing, a link for Kevin's book, as well as all the other guests we've had on here who have had books. I can tell you, I loved reading Ruffian. It's an inside look at how investigations and operations are initiated and developed, and it's a great example of what can be accomplished when you have dedicated law enforcement professionals backed by leadership at all levels, as well as the support of the prosecutors, and then they are allowed to do their jobs. Man, I highly recommend Kevin's book, so take a look at that. Kevin, brother, thank you so much again for giving us your time and giving us a look on the inside of difficult investigations. Your transparency and honesty are truly motivating. Keep up the outstanding work you're doing there, my friend. And you know what? God bless the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our responders, first responders. Keep them safe. So if you enjoyed today's episode with Kevin Grogan, a.k.a. Bootsy, check him out on Facebook and LinkedIn at Kevin Grogan, G-R-O-G-A-N. On Instagram at blacksheep_whitecop, and on X at KevinGrogan1108. And as I mentioned, I'll post his book, Ruffian, on the Game of Crimes website. Very quickly, I'd appreciate you going to Apple or Spotify, hit those 5 stars, that small act really helps support Game of Crimes, and it'll only take you a minute. Send your comments on Apple, Spotify, or to our email address, gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. There you'll find all the episodes, booklets, merch, and there's a link for Patreon. On Facebook and Instagram, go to Game of Crimes Podcast. And on X, formerly known as Twitter, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, go to Game of Crimes Fans. Click on there. You will have to answer a couple questions to gain entry. Our favorite queen, Sandy Salvato, will be there to judge you and decide whether you're worthy of entry. It's a great place to go and have a little fun. And then for more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. I have several monthly episodes. They're ranging from answering your questions to presenting you with a real crime to see if you can solve it. Again, that's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Do me a favor, tell your friends about Game of Crimes. Tell them to come on over, download the show, and give us a listen. The best advertising and marketing in the podcast world is word of mouth. Your efforts are more effective than mine, so I appreciate you helping me to spread the word about the best weekly true crime podcast available. Okay, guys, thank you once again for continuing to support Game of Crimes. Remember, we can have different ideas and different opinions, but that doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. Lastly, thanks for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next time. We'll be right back.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.